Defense policy will forever be debated, but nearly everyone agrees ways exist for the Pentagon to spend more wisely. One potential for savings comes from the prices for spare parts. It came up recently in congressional hearings. The Project on Government Oversight's Mandy Smithberger testified, and she joins me now. Mandy, good to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this issue of spare parts prices is as old as the hills, really, for the military. And what is it you told Congress, the appropriators, and what's the fundamental issue here with what it costs for spare parts?
Right. So the fundamental issue here is that there have been a lot of laws put in place that make it that much harder for the government to negotiate fair and reasonable prices. They have to jump through a number of hoops to be able to get certified cost or pricing information to determine if something is actually being offered for a fair price. And one of the biggest loopholes we have found is really misuse of what is called commercial items. Now, in a commercial environment, you actually have a market that's determining that a price is fair and reasonable. But for the government, in a lot of these cases, so-called commercial items are actually sole source, that you only have one person you're buying from, and it's really difficult to determine if you're getting a fair deal. And certainly the government questions if they're getting a fair deal when a price, you know, goes up 50% or 100% in a year.
So there are parts and pieces and sustainment items that the military needs that can be commercial. I mean, if you have a part for a fighter that is only for that particular plane, that's one thing. But I guess they have lots of vehicles and platforms and weapon systems that, at least parts of weapon systems, where there are commercial counterparts and the same part could be a lot less money?
No, so the issue is that in a number of those cases, even though the government is the only customer, and the contractor will argue that some of these parts are actually commercial because they're similar enough to something that is offered on the commercial market. And so it makes it that much more difficult for the government to get the kind of cost or pricing information that they would normally be entitled to get negotiate fair prices. So in a number of cases, the Department of Defense Inspector General has actually looked at some of these spare parts and found, even though this is labeled commercial, actually the government's the only customer. We have really no instances of seeing that there are other customers to make sure that these prices are fair.
So how can you determine if it's fair? Because if the government's the only customer and it's exclusive to something that's military, is there a way to get some reasonable level of what the government should pay for those things?
Absolutely. The companies could be required to provide the government certified cost or pricing information. And so we think particularly when you're talking about these sole source environments, that that is information that the government should be entitled to be able to negotiate those fair prices.
Give us some recent examples where you've seen this kind of thing.
Absolutely. So we've seen this with everything from, you know, small kinds of pins where it's been charged, where the cost is significantly higher, bevels, all kinds of little small parts. And in some cases, there's been an upcharge of, you know, 4,000% for a spare part. In one case, there was an engine that had not been deemed commercial before. They changed the definition of what commercial was, and then suddenly the price went up.
Interesting. Yeah, things like pins and bevels, small maintenance items. Could it be that the government itself is causing, in some ways, that kind of pricing because of the process required to acquire them that costs the contractor more? I mean, what drives the price? Or is it simply contractors feel they can get it because they are the sole source?
So I think in a number of instances, you do find that companies think that they are able to, you know, use their advantage, and honestly, they have an obligation to their shareholders to do as much as they can to make profits. So I think that can be the problem in some instances. But I think it's also in the government where they haven't really been thinking about what are the long-term sustainment costs of maintaining these weapon systems. How are we making sure that the aftermarket for these different kinds of parts aren't going to put the government in a bad position where companies can buy sole source suppliers and really have the government be in a very weak market position to negotiate fair prices.
We're speaking with Mandy Smithberger. She's a defense spending analyst at the Project on Government Oversight. Then I guess you could say this issue backs up further left in the whole supply chain with respect to how these systems are designed, and perhaps they could be designed and built with sustainment in mind in the first place, and maybe some complexity left out in favor of ease of maintenance and low cost and sustainment?
Absolutely. I think as much as possible, we want these systems to be simple to maintain, that we want service members in the field to be able to fix their own equipment to the maximum degree possible so that they're resilient and flexible.
Yeah, that's another issue, too, is the fact that very often the government cedes the contracting right to do the maintenance and repairs to the original contractor, and that can be expensive and also a logistics issue.
Absolutely. I think the department is increasingly understanding that they have been allowing themselves to be at a disadvantage, and so they are initiating initiatives to be able to negotiate more of these intellectual property rights. But, you know, obviously for a number of systems that we already own, it's tough once the milk is spilled out of the bottle to, you know, put it back in to make sure that we are controlling costs.
Yeah, how is it that the ability to maintain something is posited as an intellectual property issue? It's not as if the government is going to copy the machine and make it themselves in a government factory and sell it. How is maintenance and repair get tied to intellectual property?
So some of the things that those companies would argue is that they become concerned that if the government has information about these plans, that they could then compete this and, you know, give this information to other companies to be able to provide these services, because as you're saying, you know, it's not like the government is going to be standing up their own manufacturing. But we would actually like to see more of those opportunities to allow entrants, to allow new small businesses to be able to provide some of these services to the government and for us to see more competition. But that is, you know, one of the primary concerns from these larger companies, that where they're trying to maintain what's becoming a really profitable line for a lot of them. You've seen companies saying that, you know, the department going after our intellectual property rights is really going after a lot of our business model. So it'll be interesting to see how this proceeds.
Yeah, so legitimate, I guess, arguments on both sides, but couldn't a contract simply say we have the right to the blueprints and the plans for the purposes of sustainment and repair, and we won't share it with anyone else in industry? Wouldn't that be kind of an easy answer?
It's too easy for government work, no. Yes, we would like to see, I think in a number of these instances, that contracting officials have not felt empowered to be able to negotiate those kinds of rights to make sure that we're doing what's in the best interest of our service members in the department.
All right, and just briefly, what else did you tell Congress with respect to just keeping costs under control in this whole area of repair and sustainment? What other steps could be taken within reason in the next NDAA, for example?
I think one of the biggest ones is something that was proposed under the Obama administration, is changing the definition of commercial items to really be what we think a commercial item is, something that is sold in like quantities on the market. We would also like to see lower thresholds so that more of these contracts can include providing certified cost or pricing information so that we are going to get a good deal for this. And then as you were talking about largely with sustainment, I think the government needs to be obtaining and making available to the public more information on what are the real costs of service contracting, and rather than having some of these services brought into government or done by military personnel.
And the strange thing is there is a lot of agreement with this on the part of military personnel themselves, too, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. You hear people are probably familiar with the Right to Repair movement when it's talking about, you know, your phone or your tractor, but it's also something that we're seeing in the military as well, where they want to be able to maintain their own equipment in the field. They don't want to be dependent on contractors, just as none of us want to be dependent on tech support in order to be able to proceed with our day. They would like to see these systems be easier to maintain.
Well, let me tell you something. The first time I paid for an oil change on a motorcycle was the last time I paid for an oil change. I said, I may be an old guy, but I'm going to figure out how to do this myself, because it's 10 times as much as a car oil change. And, you know, all you need is a wrench.
Absolutely. And, you know, members of the military want to be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah, and we support that. Mandy Smithberger is a defense spending analyst at the Project on Government Oversight. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll post this interview along with a link to her testimony at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on your schedule. Subscribe at Podcast One or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. During his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the president and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970, and then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy, with six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more, because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Sea to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life, and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual, and that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop, and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career. But really, it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you used to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was, you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From C to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. When I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories as parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And my wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me. And I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons and in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gained the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, WAPA serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the U.S. Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler, and to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast. We'll see you next time.